Hello and welcome to Wax Lyrical, the advertising podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. I'm Mark.
I'm Mimi.
Hi, and I'm Paul.
And in this episode, the £100 million Brexit campaign. Is the government, or indeed anyone, getting good value from this campaign? And if the WeWork bubble bursts, will it affect our creative community? Plus new campaigns from the NHS, Lego and The Guardian.
Let's take a look.
And you've heard a new voice. Hello and welcome to Mimi, who I have met before.
Welcome. But,
please tell the listener, Mimi, a bit about yourself.
My name is Mimi Turner. I am a brand strategist. I think I've spent 20 years either in journalism or in communications or in marketing. And I work with businesses to help them identify their point of view and then execute that point of view through their products, through their creative, through their campaigns, and through their strategy.
And you did us the honour of coming to one of our Unplugged podcast recordings some time ago when we were talking about toxic masculinity and stuff like that. And I was behind the mixing desk, but I had the pleasure, genuinely, of editing that particular podcast. And without bigging you up too much, I was actually so fascinated listening to you that I forgot to do my editing bit as I was doing it. And it was on that basis, if nothing else, that I said to Paul, it would be great to spend some more time with Mimi. So I'm pleased you're here.
I'm very, very happy to be here.
One of the campaigns we've touched on, but not talked about that much, was the £100 million Brexit campaign. It struck me, I think, Mimi, when you and I were talking on the phone the other day, you said, does it seem like the government's had £100 million worth of value?
Value's a good debate.
But do you think there is £100 million worth of value from what you've seen so far?
Well, I don't think so. No, we've spoken about it before. We were fascinated. We heard bits and bobs that it was going to be £100 million and it was going to be in 2 months, which I think is probably about the end of October,
At the time of recording, we've got a month to go, more or less, haven't we?
And yeah, I don't think so. They certainly haven't spent that on the creative.
That's true.
We'll come back to that. So yeah, I've seen it frequently, I suppose, but no, I don't think I'm feeling that value. By chance, I don't think you guys have as much, but I have seen quite a few of the TV spots, which vary in size. But again, it's a couple of raps on the metro, a few bits and bobs. I would have thought they've sunk quite a bit into social media, which I'm not exposed to too much, but yeah, I don't know whether they're ramping up, but I don't think I've seen the 100 million yet.
You can sort of work it out mentally. If it were a 100 million campaign, you'd be looking to see roughly £1 million a day of media spend for 3 months. That's what you would get, right? Mm. I've seen the result of spending a couple of £1 million over a whole campaign, and I feel that I haven't seen anything like that. So when you look at creative, because I sense that's what we should think about.
Focus on, yeah.
Did it have impact? Did it communicate something to me? And did it persuade me? And actually, I looked at the weekend papers. I looked in the Sunday Times. Now, it was in the business section of the Sunday Times. So that's not, the business section of the Sunday Times is not easiest to find. And I went through all the pages. And I didn't bring it with me, but I wrote down a list of all the brand ads that had the same colour scheme. If you are going to be in the attention business, you need different colours. And this is red, white and blue, or red, blue and black, or red, pink and blue. And I think I found at least five other brand campaigns that were text in that same writing style. So HSBC, Virgin Atlantic, I can't even remember the others, but I think even Sky has some colours that are the same colours. So, the brand codes are not owned or clear or exclusive or identifiably part of this campaign.
So how much has been said about this particular conspiracy theory, which is that actually we shouldn't be spending this money, and in fact all we're doing is just signalling to Brussels that we want people to think we're serious about exiting on the 31st of October, and that it's not £100 million. That's just a more signalling to Brussels that we're really serious about leaving on the 31st of October. And look, here's an advertising campaign that shows we're really serious about leaving on the 31st of October. So kind of another double blow, or intended to be another double blow to our Eurocrats.
I mean, who knows
anymore?
So
they can see that we're serious. I don't know. How do you think about that conspiracy theory?
Well, I think before we talk about conspiracy theories, I think we should talk about the comic potential that we've seen unleashed. This is a gift for memes. I've seen fantastic memes on this ad because it just sort of asks for it. And actually, there wasn't necessarily creativity in the exposition, but there's certainly creativity in our response to it. And actually, that made me feel happy.
I've got quite a few in front of me.
The internet
actually,
is merciless.
Do you want to share some of the get ready for Brexit memes then?
Well, some of them.
Well, the ones that.
Pre-watershed. Listeners, imagine
pre-watershed.
The exact styling that we've described in terms of red, white, and blue. Get ready for scurvy. Is one. Get ready for eating foxes.
I don't understand that.
No, I didn't get that one.
I think it's we'll be returning to a more...
Some kind of feudal system.
Well, I think a more Hugh-friendly Whittingstall, kill it and eat it kind
oh,
of...
Oh, I see. Yeah. All right. Okay.
Well, that's how I read it, but, you know...
We've got different points of view there, haven't we?
You know, if 1 million people extra go to gov.uk, not in total, but on top of what the normal traffic is, then that isn't that... it's like £100 a head. The cost per acquisition was £100. Mm-hmm. If it's 2 million, then it's £50. What's a good return on your investment?
So here's a bit of a spiky question for you, Mimi. If you were still at Lad Bible, what would Lad Bible's stance on Brexit be, do you think?
One of the creative things that we did was the guys just went out to Nando's in Manchester, so just around the corner. And they interviewed some people outside Nando's, and they interviewed some people outside Greg's. And the thesis was, you know, let's test whether people who eat at Nando's are more likely to be Remainers than people who eat at Greg's. And it just weirdly turned out that that was the case, and it was completely unscientific. And that's what was really interesting about it. But when you put that piece of... I think that 26,000 people shared that piece of content. They shared it because it wasn't preaching. I think preaching to people is a bad idea.
Can you make a promise today to the British public that you will not go back to Brussels and ask for another delay to Brexit?
Yes.
And sorry.
I can.
And would you
I'd rather be dead in a ditch.
So you would resign first, Prime Minister, rather than go and ask for that delay?
It costs £1 billion a month. It achieves absolutely nothing. What on earth is the point of a further delay?
One story that's been in the news a lot is WeWork, and I wanted to just categorise it for us. Why are we talking about WeWork? I think we're talking about WeWork because so many of our friends actually either work there now or have grown there. Mm. And certainly on this podcast, we've talked about the power of the startup community in terms of changing the creativity in our world. So I do think WeWork has been an important catalyst for creativity.
And the news recently is that they've applied effectively to run an IPO in the States, and that's been delayed potentially permanently. There's a ghost-written blog that we believe we know who wrote it.
Oh, which, do you? Okay, right.
Which calls it out as completely fraudulent, and it is. It's about 25-page thing or 25 comments, and it does shine a pretty dark light on what those guys have done. And I guess the scrutiny that comes with an IPO is the biggest scrutiny you're ever going to get, and they've been found out. So I don't know what's going to come next, but I don't think it's going to be an IPO.
So
I think
story,
it is going to be an IPO.
You think it will go ahead?
I think the reason that Adam Newman has had to step down is because the investors want to IPO the business, and they might IPO it at a lot less than the $47 billion that they thought it was going to be worth.
Those numbers are just ridiculous, aren't they?
Well, you know, I have what I think is interesting about the WeWork narrative, which we are all now, it would seem that the whole world is in agreement that this was a a business that dressed itself up as a technology business when in fact it's basically Regis offices plus plus plus. Because you have this charismatic founder narrative, you know, they're going to make the world better. He believes in something that is he alone is able to crystallize from bricks and mortar. It's a tech firm, specifically a software as a service firm, which gives it a valuation of 24 times revenue as opposed to its EBITDA multiple, because it doesn't have any EBITDA. And all of these things together create a really spectacular narrative. And actually, investors fall for this narrative all the time, including, for instance, Peloton. So Peloton is a cycling as a service business, if you can describe it that way. It has 1.4 million users. It's a $2,500 bike, and you essentially it's the experiential Netflix of cycling. You
like
do an online spin class in your living room, which and it's valued. It made the IPO at $8.1 billion. So, I mean, even though we're all talking about WeWork as if it was never going to work and everybody, I don't think that exists. The problem for WeWork, I don't know whether it was fraudulent or, but I think it didn't have to be, because it was so fundamentally built on a sketchy business model. So, you know, at its heart, what WeWork did is lease properties on a long-term debt, variable debt. So it's like a mortgage, which, you know, the interest rates go up, you pay more, and their income was very short-term money, whether a day or a month or your short-term rental. So it's exactly the equivalent of buying a building, owing the bank quite a lot of money that you have to pay back every month, and then hoping every week that enough people stayed over and paid you 20 quid to make your mortgage payment. I mean, that there's no more complexity to the business, although they try to create huge amounts of mission oriented complexity, and it's just very financially vulnerable. I mean, the margin is narrow when times are good, and you know, the first thing that happens when a recession happens is that people who want to pay $65 a day to feel that they're part of a movement don't have $65 a day, and they think, well, actually better do what all entrepreneurs have done, which is work from my kitchen table and save myself $60. So that's why the business is vulnerable, and the narrative that they have just falls apart, because actually they don't have any pricing power. It's not like WeWork own 90% of commercial property so that they can get a better deal on their leases. They just don't have that ability in the market. They don't have scale effects, although the business is built on an assumption of massive scale. The more people who want to rent your property, the more properties you have to have. It's not like radio, where you create a product for one person, or pharma, you create a pill that makes one person better and then 10 billion other people can buy that same product. A business is stymied by scale.
I think it's really hard when you're starting out to follow your dreams. I think it's really, really hard. We started in our living room, essentially. And I think what's appealing about WeWork for us as a company is that it makes your life extremely easy.
The first day of building a business is a big day, because that's the day when the full dreams come into play. But then the second day, reality kicks in. Where's my office? Who's my internet provider? How am I going to pay for electricity? Where am I going to get sales from? At WeWork, we really strive to help you as much as we can. Focus on doing what you love. Create your life's work and let us take care of the rest.
We've talked in previous episodes about the direct-to-consumer explosion, and a brand I wasn't expecting to move into that space was Nestlé, and in particular, Kit Kat. Tell us about this one, Paul.
It's unlike us not to talk about food, isn't it, in a podcast?
Yes.
we rarely navigate a podcast without being about food. So today is chocolate, as you said. So Nestlé are moving into the DTC space. And yeah, you're right. We've talked about this explosion, and more of the kind of the bigger established brands that weren't born out of DTC are now moving into that space. We've mentioned Gillette not that long ago, moving into the premium space, and this term premiumization, I can't even say it really, but it's a new phrase for me, where brands are moving into that kind of higher price product but going direct to consumer. So this is Kit Kat. It is £14 a bar, and yeah, their movement into a premium product. Basically, it's going to be available on Nestlé's website, some pop-up shops, I think within John Lewis. They've got a kind of John Lewis-y Christmassy tie-up brand kind of brand synergy there around the price point. But yeah, we should discuss what it means for such a big business that aren't traditionally in D2C trying to get into that kind of space. I know you have some thoughts, Mimi.
Well, I have lots of thoughts about chocolate, all of them good. Unfortunately, we just don't have time to go into those here. But on this Kit Kat story, I've seen some beautiful, beautiful pictures, and I've seen lots of will it work, and I've seen, I think there's a piece in the Mail about it was a fantastic experience. I went to the shop. And from what I think is that this feels to me as though this is a by-the-book bungling of a brand extension, or maybe I don't know whether it's a brand extension or a line extension, but I do think it is. My prediction is that this is a really bad idea. And I was trying to think, Kit Kat, what kind of brand associations does Kit Kat own? What is its heritage? It's an iconic brand. I bet is in the top five of British chocolate bars, are one of our favourites. What's that heritage based on? What is Kit Kat really good at? And, you know, it's low price. It's low price. It's popular. It's distributed. So everywhere I go, from a newsagent on St. Martin's Lane to Tesco or Asda or, you know, Sainsbury's or Waitrose, it's distributed there. And it's mass produced. And, you know, I think we're sometimes sniffy about mass production. I think mass production is a modern miracle. I was going to swear there, but I'm not going to swear there. But it's a modern miracle. Literally every Kit Kat that I have ever had tasted like every other Kit Kat. Human beings are unbelievably clever, and sometimes we might not be able to solve our politics, but every Kit Kat that everybody has ever had tasted like every other Kit Kat. That's pretty cool. So I think they have done very, very difficult things, and they have earned their place, because even more than all of those things, Kit Kat have done this thing which I think is marketing and branding made real, which is, I know when I'm supposed to have a Kit Kat. I want to have a break, then I'm going to have a Kit Kat. That is what they have invested millions, if not actual billions of pounds, in being experts at. I know everything about what that experience is going to be. The last time it was a good experience, I had a break, I had a Kit Kat, it was great, it was the Kit Kat I was expecting. So this is what they're really good at. They own the moment. They've actually developed a product, defined a moment, and I do the action. That is very, very good. But let's look at what they're not good at, what they have zero heritage in. They have zero heritage, zero experience, and zero claim to be credibly good in this space. They have no heritage in artisan chocolate. Artisan chocolate is an interesting space, and it is a growing space, but it's not something that Kit Kat have any expertise in, or any reason to put their brand on it. They don't have any insight into premium pricing or defense of premium pricing. It's an FMCG business. I spend it, and you know, I don't think about that. I don't think about the product. £14 is a different pricing model. And for premium pricing, so when I buy a Kit Kat, I don't really know what the price of a Kit Kat is. It might be 65 pence if I'm buying it in a newsagent. But, you know, when I go to Waitrose, you know, it might be on offer. It's a frequently discounted product. Sometimes I buy it for £1.65. Sometimes I buy the same six two-finger Kit Kats for £1. So they are the opposite of defending premium pricing. Premium is about holding your pricing and creating the brand. They have no artisan brand as a premium product. They have no experience of customization. This is a customized product. Sometimes you have to go away, you give your order, you come back for two hours later, and then you pick up your product. Mm. This is not a product. They don't know how to do demand generation, and they have no experience in online sales and packaging. Online sales and packaging is often overlooked, but it is entirely different. You know, the packaging relationship that Kit Kat have built is based on their red colour, their silver. You're trained to see it on the shelf. That's what retail distribution is about. The 10 metres from the shelf, the product sticks out. You move a metre towards it, the packaging sticks out. In online, it's totally different. It's black and white, and it's, you know, it's a different skill set to develop packaging for a D2C online product. So they don't have that experience. And
there's something going on there, right? So we've mentioned Gillette, we've got Kit Kat, we've got Cadbury's recently going into their kind of like, what do they call it, chocolate for grown-ups with their dark milk, they've called it. You've got Pernod Ricard ramping up their investment in premium brands. So there's something happening here where the other brands are shifting into it. And I agree with you, I think commercially the Kit Kat move doesn't make sense, but it's a brand play, right? Yeah. In terms of establishing, the automotive industry have done it a lot in terms of whenever they're bringing out a kind of entry level model. Certainly our experience with Porsche, it was always the way. If an entry level model came out, there'd always be a real premium product just to make sure the brand was established a certain way. But that's very different. I acknowledge that Kit Kat have never been in that space. But what's happening then? We're talking about Kit Kat, but there's many other FMCG giants that are doubling down, it appears, in the premium space.
I think where a direct-to-consumer success story comes from is somewhere different. It is somebody who really cares about the nature of that product. A friend of mine launched a line of hemp oil, and he launched it by going around the world and speaking to hemp producers and creating a sort of, you know, really interesting and beautifully curated Instagram presence, and then they use the platform to launch the product. It's about direct-to-consumer products come about, gain visibility because they create a story around their mission. And this is not what we're seeing. I don't think this Kit Kat product, I mean, I could be completely wrong, but I don't think this is really an extension of any kind. Actually, I think this is a tactic. Somebody said, we need something experiential. We need something that's going to get some PR. We need something that people are going to talk about. I know, let's get a £14 Kit Kat. Actually, I think the £14 Kit Kat that would really, really, really sell is if they put £14 worth of Kit Kat into a single Kit Kat and put that on the shelf. I literally would buy it for every bloke I know at Christmas. £14 of Kit Kat in a giant Kit Kat, that would work. But if you want something like an artisan piece of chocolate which has a story around the origin of its beans, and it has roses, or it has, you know, caramel flavour, just go around to Hotel Chocolate. It's just around the corner, and they'll sell it to you for less than 14 quid. Give me a break, give me a break, break me off a piece of that Kit Kat.
So it's time to take a look, or in our case, listen to some new campaigns. And the first one that we picked is for Lego. I'll put my cards on the table. Love this. It is a dazzling visual journey of all things that I kind of remember as a kid. And Mimi's reminded me, it's very reminiscent, some might say plagiaristic, of P-Town, Crazy Town, which was
Lazy
that.
Town.
Lazy Town. Town. Yeah, I'm not the target market, Mimi, if you remember. I'm in my 50s. Visually it's quite reminiscent of Lazy Town. But I did love it. But we have, before we were recording, debated whether or not we think it actually works. And who is it aimed at?
I've got a lot of investment in Lego. I think I'd be the devil's advocate on this. I didn't know it was a Lego advert. It is beautiful and coloured and animated. But it's not animated in the form of Lego. It's just animated as a cartoon. So I actually wrote down all the things I thought this might be an ad for. So I wrote down safari, because it seemed like it might be a safari. I wrote down air freshener.
Where did you get air freshener from?
When he opens the toilet and he goes...
Oh, yes, he does. Home. Yeah, okay, fine.
I wrote down Harley Davidson.
Yeah.
I wrote down holiday. I wrote down Disneyland. And then I wrote down diner. So for me, an advert has to express to a consumer what it is an ad for. If you don't do that, you have no hope of recall, which is the job. Now, I think this might work for Lego, because I think everybody knows Lego, and this is an ad that maybe plays into that. You already know it, so when you see it at the end, it turns into kind of a Lego structure, and you go, oh yeah, Lego, I love Lego. So maybe that works, but I think ads start with words. It is, you know, a proposition where you need to know. So on that basis, loved as it was, a fortune they've already spent on Lego, and I didn't think it was as good as their movies, which are a much better vehicle special, for their product.
Rebuild the world. Lego! And the next campaign we're going to look at is for the NHS. It's their recruitment campaign. It's called Simply, We Are Nurses, We Are the NHS.
We're 3 years of training before we're a minute on the job.
there isn't anybody. There isn't anybody who doesn't like nurses. There isn't anybody who doesn't like the NHS. We like that. You know, so the ad, which is moving, is moving. It is totally by the numbers. It's like painting by numbers. It's a formulaic, formatted, five expositions of nurses, a brand new baby, an old person, a vulnerable person. But it can be all of those and still be incredibly persuasive. And as I said, it made me want to be feeling those feelings.
Did you fancy being a nurse?
For 45 seconds, I thought, that looks like a really worthy thing to do. The problem is that nurses don't want to be nurses, and that is the bigger problem. Nurses feel that their skill, their expertise, their tenderness, their compassion is exploited by the NHS, and that is a problem. Retention, not acquisition.
I know you want to jump in, Paul, but before I let Mimi go, I'm going to put this to you, as they would say in the best kind of radio kind of debate, that, and forgive the planner in me coming to the fore now, I think there's more going on in this ad than just recruiting nurses. I think it is an attempt to restore faith in the NHS, and I would disagree with you that everybody loves nurses. I suspect because of the incredible pressure that patients are under to have to fight for every single bit of care that they need, I think there's probably some nurses, if not a lot of nurses, on the front line who are feeling that kind of pressure. So I think it's a bit of, don't take it out on the nurses, because they're trying to do the best they can with the limited resources they've got available. There are 41,000 nursing vacancies in the NHS at the moment. That is massive. Yeah. That means that they're doing...
one in every 10 nursing positions is vacant.
That means they're doing more than nursing, because there's not enough people to do the nursing. And so that is dreadful. You know, I've been in hospital a lot recently because I've got two ageing relatives, and you have to fight for care. You literally do. And my mum, who was in most recently, she's of a different generation. Oh, don't bother the nurses. She'd almost rather die than bother a nurse, because the nurse is too busy to actually look after her. You know, there's all that kind of stuff. So I think it's doing more than recruiting nurses. I think it's trying to restore faith in the NHS. And I think it is trying to actually be a bit of a moral boost to the nurses themselves. It's advertising to its own community, which I think is kind of what you were saying
if it does that, and if it does anything to support the morale of nurses, then that would be an untrammeled good thing.
It positions it very positively. I immediately jumped to thinking about some of the teacher ads we've seen over the last few years, which actually position it very positively, and the enrichment of your life and the children's lives of being a teacher. And you just sort of leave there, I guess, like you're saying, Mimi, for a very short period, you're like, oh, that's what a wonderful career choice. Well, actually, I think we need to be a bit more punchy and actually show a slightly more realistic view of what's going on. Introduce some jeopardy, maybe, or start to show what it is really like, because we are quite a cynical nation, and we will very quickly just be like, well, that's not what it's like.
We are nurses. We are the NHS. We are recruiting now. Search nursing careers.
Last but by no means least, for the first time in a long time, I can't remember how long, we have a new campaign for the Grawny ad, as I was taught to call them. I'm showing my age. I'm sure nobody says that anymore, do they, Mimi? Is it still called the Grawny ad?
I have no idea what you're talking about, so yes.
Do you know where that comes from? Oh, the Grawny ad. So in my day, the Guardian was famous for its typos. It had poor copy reading, poor proofing.
Quality control.
Yes, and so it was known as the Grawny ad.
I never knew that.
Ah, see. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I didn't, you know, the first time I watched it, I was distracted because something happened and I missed the punchline. So should we just describe it? It's a butterfly trapped in a room, and we are meant to identify with this butterfly that is trying to escape this... beautiful, empty, sunlit room, and the windows won't allow it to do that. And it's a Red Admiral, and it's thwarted and in despair, and we're supposed to identify with that. And then at some point, and you have to watch carefully because it's not after first 5 seconds, the butterfly smashes through the window, and the message is something about hope. Sometimes hope happens, or I can't even remember what it was.
Hope is power,
because it was such a crappy message. And the fact is, the problem with this is that butterflies don't break glasses. If you're hoping for that, then you might as well drop dead now. That does not happen. Every other thing, and also there's no mention of the Guardian. There's no visibility. This is a butterfly ad. Oh no, there it goes. And it flies away, having broken the window. change is possible, and the visualization of possible change is a butterfly that can break a window.
Yeah, it's an interesting time. You've got the FT advertising, you've got The Economist on a campaign recently. There's obviously something in the water for kind of for publishers doing big campaigns recently. My first thought on the ad was that panelling on the wall is very nice. I think my wife would love it. That was one of my first thoughts. Nice colour.
Nice house.
Nice house. Very
house.
Nice house.
Yeah.
I guess I like that they're trying to stand for something. And Mimi, you did a very good way of explaining what they've been up to in terms of asking people for help. And actually, we had an event recently where someone from The Guardian was on, and it has made a huge difference to their business, and they're fortunate in that they're asking in a way which actually is getting people to help. So I like they're trying to stand for something, but anybody could be saying this. Literally anybody could be saying this line.
I think the media has benefited from populism, particularly in the past few months, where the pace of news has been so fast. I mean, I told you, I now go home and on average watch 3 news bulletins when I get home. I get home and I watch the end of ITV at 6:30. I then put on Channel 4 for 7. Then I either watch Sky at 9 or BBC again at 10, because it has been changing that quickly. And the newspapers are reporting an upturn in circulation as a result, because people are genuinely interested in news, because for once real life is more interesting than fiction. It is crazy at the moment, and I wonder if that's why The Economist and The Guardian and The Times and the FT are all selling again, because there's been a bit of an uptick in interest in traditional news media as a result. I love this, because I think there's again several levels going on. I do think that the hope thing is there, but you're right, why haven't they pushed their free journalism thing, which is their USP, really, isn't it? You know, there's no paywall at The Guardian. You can get access to everything free of charge. It's disappointing that hasn't been spelled out. There is branding there. It's quite at the end. But I'm going to defend it on that level. I think there is a renaissance in news media at the moment, and they're trying to jump on that particular bandwagon. As Paul said, Mimi, it's been fascinating having a CMO in the room. You've made us much more commercially conscious today, so thank you for that overwhelming contribution. And I love how when you're cynical, you're always smiling. I know you can't see that in audio, but when Mimi's cynical, she smiles. Yeah. You're the smiling cynic. That's amazing.
It's been lovely to have you here. Thank you for coming on.
Well, it's been fantastic. And if you need smiling cynic contributions, you can count on me. I've really enjoyed it. I hope I haven't been too negative. Seeing things from a business perspective it just is a discipline, because businesses don't have that much money to spend on marketing. So every penny has to count.
Great.